WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday. That means it's time to take a look back at the last 7 days and the top local stories you should know but might have missed. We'll take you behind the headlines. From the fast-approaching Republican National Convention.
The four-day event will feature televised speeches from several high-profile Republicans and is widely expected to serve as Trump's platform for announcing his running mate.
To drama among Democrats.
Illinois Democratic Congressman Brad Schneider says while he loves Joe Biden, the best thing for the country right now is for the president not to run.
And the devastating news that over the July 4th weekend, more than 100 people were shot.
Local leaders and advocates, they're all calling for more community violence intervention efforts.
To hear more, I sat down with a panel of journalists. Alice Yin, Chicago Tribune political reporter, Paris Schutz, political correspondent for Fox 32, and Patrick Smith, WBEZ's urban affairs editor. I started off by asking about the three Illinois Congress members calling for President Biden to bow out. Here's Paris.
That's correct. Two more yesterday. Eric Sorensen from a downstate congressional district and then Brad Schneider from the North Shore. Schneider's in one of these districts that had been kind of purple. It leans more blue, but he said basically he was at eight parades and everyone came up to him and said, we got to do something about the Democratic ticket. We like Joe Biden, but we just don't think that he has the juice anymore after that debate performance. And so he came out yesterday in a calculated way to say he thinks that Biden should, quote unquote, pass the torch. He didn't say to who. I asked him to the vice president, Kamala Harris. He said she's one possibility. J.B. Pritzker is another possibility. The governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear. Mm-hmm. The first person that came out in Illinois was Mike Quigley.
Yeah.
And so Biden, at this point, you saw his press conference last night. It doesn't matter who comes out. He's fervently and defiantly not going to back down, at least not yet.
So Schneider joins Quigley, right? Who Quigley, as we know, doubled down his calls for Biden to step aside. Now, I mean, Quigley's been saying he expects more Democrats to join him, Paris. I mean, as far as you know, are Illinois other Democrats, are they still backing Biden?
Yeah, I mean, so it's how many of them have taken a wait-and-see approach. And the concern with Quigley and others is the effect on the down-ballot races. So they're not only afraid of losing the White House, which would be catastrophic in their mind, but also losing the House and losing the Senate because of Biden's unpopularity. So they believe more Democrats will come out. Interestingly, Biden's strongest base of support is the Congressional Black Caucus. So if you talk to the African-American Congressman, Robin Kelly put out a statement strongly in support of Biden, Danny Davis, Jonathan Jackson. Those are the ones that are strongly still backing Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, who basically made Biden's campaign in 2020 saying, I'm all in on Biden. Mm. So Biden is really counting on, you know, that's kind of his base right now, African-American lawmakers. And he's hoping to kind of stem the tide with that.
You know, I think it's interesting. WBEZ politics reporter Tessa Weinberg has a story out today. She spoke to young delegates for Biden who all said, you know, we're still with him 100%. I think it was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who spoke to delegates from Georgia who, of the 50 they reached, I think 96% said they had no hesitation for supporting him. Now, obviously, if you're a delegate for Biden, maybe you're especially already in the tank for him. But I think that's interesting. You get lower down out of the public officials and the politicians and the sort of what really is the Democratic base. Maybe we're hearing actually they're all fine despite the debate performance.
Let's add one more. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, who said yesterday defiantly, why is there even a debate? Mm. He was all in on Biden. So Biden is delivered for the city of Chicago. He's delivered for cities across the country. And so it's African-American politicians, but also the progressive politicians that weren't so hot on Biden 4 years ago that are like, no, he's delivered. You know, why are we even having this debate right now? But it goes back to his debate before. And then you saw Biden last night. He was very detailed and in-depth on the NATO press conference on China and on Russia and on arming Ukraine. But then he had those slip-ups calling Vice President Harris, Vice President Trump, oops, a little goof. And then earlier in the day, referring to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky as Ukrainian President, President Putin. And he quickly corrected himself. I mean, not President Putin.
And so joked around.
It's those verbal gaffes that concern people. It's not that folks don't like Biden or agree that he's had a very active and successful first term. It's, can he carry this across the finish line and do it for four more years?
Alice, how nervous do you think other Democratic politicians are to speak out against Biden? Do you think that's on their minds?
Yeah, I think I'm plugged more into the City Hall side. I know, as Paris mentioned, Mayor Brandon Johnson, I think he is the biggest city mayor backing Biden, obviously.
Yeah.
Mayors Eric Adams and Karen Bass are releasing statements in support, but because of what Johnson has to do in shepherding the city for the DNC, he is out there saying, you know, Donald Trump is trying to resurrect the Confederacy, et cetera, multiple times this week.
Yeah, speaking out against Biden would probably not be on his agenda.
It's also, I mean, it's kind of bad politics. Like, listen, as a journalist, I'm never going to tell a politician not to say the truth about how they feel and what they're hearing from their constituents. But the politics of Biden saying, there's just no way I'm stepping down. But then you just have constantly these high profile Democrats saying he really should is kind of like the worst possible way the Democratic Party could be going about this. Right.
Well, there were some Democrats who spoke up earlier and they, I feel like, got shuttled away. Like, the Democratic congressman from Texas, I'm forgetting his name,
Lloyd Doggett or
it was like years. It was like during the primaries last time. Yeah. So there is a risk, like you could get shuttled away into the corner.
Well, so far J.B. Pritzker still backs Biden. I want to hear what he had to say on Tuesday.
You can see that I'm all in for Joe Biden. Joe Biden's going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. I'm going to go out there and wholeheartedly campaign for him.
Yeah. So although Governor Pritzker continues to back Biden, his name keeps coming up as a potential alternate candidate. I've been hearing that. I'm sure you have too. So how well do you all think that he's walking that tightrope of just positioning himself as a possible candidate while supporting the president?
Well, he went on CNN last week to say he was concerned that he didn't think the president was getting out there enough after the debate to sort of quell those fears, hold press conferences. He finally did 2 weeks after the debate. And then this week, Pritzker's like, no, I'm all in on Biden. If you're the governor, as Patrick said, or the mayor, it's not good politics to get on Biden's bad side. Because if he wins, you do want his largesse. You do want federal money coming to Illinois and to Chicago. You don't want to tick him off. But, you know, then Pritzker was caught on hot mic saying, you know, I don't like where we're at. Saying, you know, acknowledging the polls are bad. And if you're to believe them, that Biden doesn't have much of, at this point, doesn't seem like he has much of a path to victory. So I think, you know, we haven't heard. Here's one prominent Democrat we haven't heard from, Senator Dick Durbin. He's a senior, you know, ranking Democrat. Where is he? We haven't heard a thing from him. And what he says could hold a lot of weight.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
All right, let's head 90 minutes north to Milwaukee for the RNC. You're going there next week, Paris?
I'll be staying in Racine at the Days Inn. Uh-oh, I just outed it. Yeah,
oh,
we couldn't get a hotel room in Milwaukee, but yeah, it's going
to
be...
You'll have a mob of people outside trying to see you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the RNC it's kind of taken a back seat to all this Biden speculation right now, the news, but that's going to kick up next week. The big questions are, who is Donald Trump going to choose as his running mate? He seems to be really milking the attention on that and the mystery on that. As far as Illinois is concerned, they're, as we speak, electing a new chairman of the Illinois Republican Party, which is a very beleaguered party. They're not going to be the favored folks over at the RNC because the Republican Party barely has a presence in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see how that shakes out. And so Illinois is not going to play a huge role in the RNC. You know, Illinois obviously playing a much bigger role in the DNC.
Yeah, there's quite a upheaval among Illinois Republicans lately. Any minute we're expecting them to announce their replacement for Don Tracy, the state's Republican chairperson who resigned 3 weeks ago. Who are the finalists, Paris?
Aaron Del Mar, who's out in Palatine. Kathy Salvey, another suburban. She ran for Senate against... Against Tammy Duckworth and lost. And then a third, someone fill me in a third. I think the key to remember here is...
Kathy Salvey, Aaron Del Mar, John Cabello.
Oh, John Cabello.
John Cabello.
These are all three strong MAGA, quote-unquote, you know, Trump supporters. And that's a lot of folks that have left the Republican Party in Illinois complain that's why they're leaving. They're going that MAGA direction.
Yeah.
And
are we hearing rumblings about who might win?
I think I've heard Salvey was a favorite. Again, very, very conservative, culturally conservative. And I talked to a former House Speaker or House Minority Leader, Jim Durkin, who's more of a moderate Republican. And he's like, the more MAGA we go, the less we're going to win in Illinois. We're already in super minority status, but, you know, the suburbs don't like this. And it's just going to put us more into Siberia.
Mm. We're also still waiting for Trump's vice presidential pick, Alice. I mean, shouldn't that person have been named already?
Yeah, I will say I started my journalism career like the first year of Trump's term, and
lucky
I have never
you.
Seen yep. I have never seen him this restrained. I mean, obviously he's still posting on Truth Social, but I think his advisors are telling him very much like, let Joe Biden take the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
Do not like. I have no idea who his pick is going to be, but I think he's getting advice to not take the spotlight away from the concerns over Joe Biden now.
Yeah, there's also speculation that there could be some Democratic drama timed perfectly just to detract attention from the RNC. Could you all see something like that happening? I think I could.
Well, I think there's stories. Now he wants to delay it even further and not announce it until like when he absolutely has to, when the nominee's supposed to speak at the convention. I mean, maybe he wants to hold it out longer than that. Yeah, I mean, it's all for... I mean, Donald Trump, what he is a master of TV and a master of marketing and public relations. And he's, again, milking it for all it's worth. I mean, speaking of milking it, there's a great New York Times story today about how he's milking sort of the persecution complex for a lot of money, selling Bibles, the Trump Bibles
oh,
for
geez.
$70 and those gold sneakers for $300.
Sneakers.
I mean, you know, I'm going to just throw the G word out there. Kind of sounds like a grift to me, you know, when you're monetizing that. These shirts with his mugshot. So
yeah.
I think he's happy, you know, avoiding the spotlight for now and trying to make as much money as he can off of this.
So we've been talking a lot over the past few months about potential protests here in August. How's Milwaukee preparing for the possibility of protests, Patrick?
Yeah, so organizers in Milwaukee, they're predicting thousands of people are going to protest on the first day of the RNC. Based on reporting from Wisconsin Public Radio, they're having a similar fight there to one that's playing out here, which is, you know, the city denied permits to have a protest march, like right at the steps of where the convention is being held.
Mm-hmm.
And in Milwaukee, so here in Chicago, that is still playing out in federal court, how close protesters are going to be able to get to the convention itself. In Milwaukee, a judge sided with the city and said, yeah, you can kind of keep people cordoned off. So we're seeing a very similar fight happening in the courts in Milwaukee. And then also very similarly, there's sort of these security perimeters where nobody's going to be allowed in. There's designated protest zones where they say they've got a platform for speakers and people are registering to hold protests and speak there. And like Chicago, the police in Milwaukee are saying they are going to perfectly balance safety and order with people's First Amendment rights.
Well, Alice, I want to turn now to preparations for the Democratic convention. Now, the city announced It's closing up one of the largest, most visible homeless camps. What are the details of that?
Yeah, so this is in the footprint of the United Center. I believe it's near the Dan Ryan and Des Plaines in the West Loop. And it kind of does track with, you know, a trend I see where they also, the administration has also attempted to move a migrant shelter in the Loop, the Standard Club, to the 11th Ward. But that plan was shot down by Alderman Nicole Lee, who said she was told that they wanted to do this before the DNC. Mm-hmm. And it again shows this role of Mayor Brandon Johnson trying to balance the role of shepherding mm-hmm. Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee while also catering to his progressive base, where I feel like this is also an example of a trend of something where if Lori Lightfoot had did it, what would that base be saying? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We heard strong language from the head of the police union this week about canceled days off and how that could impact officer morale going into the DNC, Pat. What did John Catanzaro have to say?
Yes, so Catanzaro was specifically warning about recently CPD has started relying more on canceling officers' days off to make sure they have enough officers on the street for summer, you know, unfortunately violent summer days sometimes. And what Catanzaro essentially is saying is that if you keep doing that in the build-up to the DNC, officers are going to be burnt out, morale is going to be terrible. The fact is, whatever the DNC is like, whether we get, you know, mayhem or truly peaceful, ordered protest, it's going to be a lot of work on police officers. Their days off are going to be canceled then, if, you know, or people are going to be working around the clock for the police department. And so Catanzaro, you know, whatever you think about him in other cases, is just doing exactly what you'd expect a union leader to do here, which is advocate for his people. He's saying,
yeah,
if you keep canceling days off, that's not going to be good for morale or people's capacity to do the tough job they're going to have to do in August. Real quick, I mean, there's some backstory here. The former superintendent, David Brown, he relied a lot on canceled days off to try to make sure they had enough police on the streets during his tenure. It was one of the reasons why officers, frankly, hated David Brown so much. Current Superintendent Larry Snelling, he pledged to not do that nearly as much. He says, Snelling says, canceled days off are down 70% this year compared to last year, despite the fact that they are using it more this summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a specific quote here from Catanzaro says, he says, unless the superintendent reins this nonsense in, morale is about to start fading away really fast before the huge convention that's going to turn this city upside down on its head. End quote.
Yeah, and the rein in, he's talking specifically, he says Chief of Patrol John Hine has been telling other supervisors, cancel whatever days off you have to. He's blaming Hine. He says, Snelling, you know, essentially you said you were going to rein this in, so rein it in.
Yeah, Alice, what do you think about how prepared the city's police are for this convention?
Yeah, I know the OIG, and maybe Patrick, you know more about this, but I know the OIG released a report showing some concerns. And to be fair, they will have, you know, the backing of the Secret Service and other federal partners. But yeah, all these roiling, like, First Amendment lawsuits and stuff have me wondering how this is all going to play out. Because as we've seen with the college protests and the encampments, when you tell protesters they can't do something, they usually will do it more.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, I'm not saying what the city should do. I understand that they have to, you know, defer to their federal partners and they have to keep the delegate safe and the convention safe. It does seem like if you make it impossible for anyone to have a legal protest close to the convention, you're making it more likely there's going to be, you know, unrest.
So we are going to have to turn to some really tragic news from this week. Mm. Mayor Johnson's promising consequences. He's also seeking federal help after more than 100 people were shot over the 4th of July weekend, 21 of whom died, significantly higher than the 11 people that were killed 1 year ago over the same holiday weekend. Pat, I know this has been your beat for many years. I am curious how you cover this as a reporter year after year and try to do this in an empathetic way without treating all these deaths as mere numbers and stats.
Yeah, I mean, well, first and foremost, it's talking to people. It's centering the voices and experiences of the people who've been shot, who've lost loved ones, the people who live in the areas that get hardest hit by gun violence. And for me, it's often meant trying to talk to the people who are doing the work in the communities trying to prevent gun violence. Another thing that I struggle with is trying to balance giving an accurate picture of the problem without losing that humanity that you're talking about. I mean, before this violent weekend that we just had, long holiday weekend that we had, we were trending downward on gun violence in the city. Right now, we're still about 8% down as far as murders compared to last year.
Okay.
Shootings total are about even compared to 2023. So sometimes I think there can be fear-mongering about how things are worse than they've ever been. And I think it's important to push back on that when it's inaccurate. But I also don't ever want to be the person who looks at people's lives lost or lives forever altered and say, well, hey, you know, the numbers actually aren't quite as bad as they were last year, so everything's okay. And I'm sorry to monologue here, but I also just, I have to note, like, we had multiple shootings over that long weekend that had multiple victims. You know, five victims, eight victims, a couple with four people shot. And sometimes these cases, children shot, children killed. Cases where we had shootouts back and forth and multiple people were wounded. And it's like impossible to overstate how much that sort of activity just destabilizes entire communities. It makes people justifiably feel like they just can't even go outside. They can't enjoy themselves on top of the people who actually lose loved ones or are shot themselves.
Very valid points, Pat. The mayor addressed the violence at a press conference on Monday. He struck a bit of a different tone than we're used to hearing from him. Let's listen.
This is enough. We need to ensure that we are holding every single individual accountable for the pain and trauma and the torment that they have caused in this city. And there will be consequences. There will be consequences for the violence. We will not let criminal activity ruin and harm our city.
So I think we can all agree there should be consequences in this case. I mean, Paris, what kind of consequences could this mayor deliver that past mayors couldn't?
Boy, that's a million-dollar question. I haven't heard, you know, anything from him that sort of differs from what other mayors have done. I mean, he pointed the finger at the federal government. He said we need more federal help. But I actually talked to the head of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention in the White House and said, we're giving it to Chicago. And this is the first mayor that's actually been able to take advantage of it because it's an initiative of President Biden. It started up in 2023. And the guy, his name was Greg Jackson. He said, I was on the phone with the mayor's team all weekend. I've been on the phone with the Department of Justice and eight different federal agencies. There is a federal coordinated effort to help Chicago. Chicago's not alone. So it was good to hear Mayor Johnson show that kind of directness and anger because he got a little criticism. First of all, he was out of town on the 4th of July, on the actual 4th, and he flew back in on Friday evening to just in time to hit one of those rallies. You know, that's not a good look. That's not good optics. You know that the 4th of July weekend is always going to be a violent weekend in Chicago, and typically mayors are supposed to be there, at least with the appearance that they're trying to take control of the situation.
Yeah.
And we didn't hear from him until Monday. That's a problem. So, and you know, he's talked a lot about historical inequities. He's brought up Richard Nixon and LBJ, and all these things might be accurate. But I think folks want to see, well, what are you doing for us now? How are you taking control and owning this situation? So I didn't hear much from the police superintendent or the mayor in terms of what they're going to do differently, other than, and we're going to talk about this, this $100 million that's going to go to community violence intervention.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a moment. But Alice, I'm curious, you heard Paris mention the federal government plea that, that the mayor made. What kind of help could the federal government provide, you think?
It could be anything from, I guess, the funding Paris is talking about to boots on the ground, which I don't think that was what he was alluding to. But, you know, other mayors have asked for that kind of help.
Yeah, he's saying that they're like Highland Park got this emergency response after their mass shooting. So treat Chicago like you're treating these other towns that experienced mass shootings. But once again, when I spoke to the White House, I said, we're doing that. We're already doing that. I mean, more than the federal government ever has with Chicago. And so the mayor's saying more victim support. Federal government, we got that. They're sponsoring that victim center on Racine on the south side that opened up. You know, every mayor, I mean, they point the finger at guns. Yes, that's a problem. They point the finger at the state. They point the finger at the federal government, at the state's attorney.
It's kind of
rhetorical sleight of hand when you just don't have answers.
Yeah. Patrick, what did we hear from Snelling?
Well, it was Johnson actually got more specific about the federal help that, you know, victim support services like Paris is talking about. He actually did say we want more boots on the ground for going after illegal guns and the you know, the sort of flow of guns into Chicago, which again, to Paris's point, is a pretty familiar talking point. I mean, that Office of Fire and Violence Prevention that Paris is talking about, there's a pretty high-ranking member of it who used to be an anti-violence worker in Chicago, Eddie Bocanegra's there. I mean, there's a big focus on Chicago from the Justice Department. But I will say, You know, I covered the mass shooting in Highland Park, and I covered a mass shooting in Garfield Park 2 years ago.
Yeah.
The response is different overall. And so I understand what the mayor is talking about, but he has some control over that, too.
Yeah.
You know, the response, he wasn't the mayor when the mass shooting happened in Garfield Park that I'm talking about, but it's not like the mayor is not active in deciding how the city responds to these kinds of tragedies.
Well, let's listen to Snelling. He did mention one kind of free help that he could use.
We need every single person to step up. Please give us information. And I'll tell you, most of the cases where we've been able to solve fairly quickly, it's because we've had outreach from the community.
So he's not the first police superintendent and probably won't be the last to turn to the public for help. What did you hear as you covered this, you know, for so long in Chicago, Pat? Like, have people shared fears with you about going to the cops with information?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, what you have is a kind of twofold problem. CPD does such a poor job solving murders. There's been incremental progress. Mayor Johnson has promised and started to deliver on more detectives to try to address that issue. Rahm said he was going to address that issue. I don't remember, but I'm sure Lightfoot said she was going to address the issue of murder clearances. So the twofold problem is, one, they don't solve most murders. So people kind of feel like, well, what's the point of me sticking my neck out? They don't ever arrest anybody anyway. Mm-hmm. And two, I have spent time with victims and witnesses to shootings who have cooperated and felt like they were sort of left out. Like they were like, people know where I live. I'm not getting any support. And I feel like I'm going to be targeted again because I'm cooperating. And they end up in this sort of morass where there's not much support for witnesses. It's not like, you know, you go into witness protection if you cooperate with CPD.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have a legitimate concern. I'm not saying people shouldn't step up. Of course, I hope they do, but they have legitimate fears.
Do you feel like when you're door knocking back in the day, like even people would be afraid of you as reporters, like being seen on the street, like talking to you? Maybe you're mistaken for, you know, law enforcement or whatever, because I felt like that as a reporter.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you're out there and it's like the person who will talk to you is the person who's like, I don't give a damn if they see me talking to you. But there are most people who are like, no, I don't
want to get involved. Please get off my door. I don't want
to
get
you can come inside, but I'm not going to stand out here and talk to you.
I remember talking to a small drugstore owner in North Lawndale and basically said to me, if I see a shooting or if I see gang activity, I don't go to the police.
Mm.
And that's why they leave me alone. You know, they leave my store alone because they know that I'm not going to rat them out.
Right.
And that's, to Patrick's point, therein lies the problem. You know,
lots of people are thinking the exact same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we get nowhere. Alice, the mayor campaigned on prioritizing youth employment as one way to reduce violence. How's he doing on actually meeting the promise?
Yeah, so that was a big part of his 100-day agenda. He campaigned on doubling youth employment, treatment, not trauma, and bring Chicago home. And to be frank, you know, no one really expects the 100-day agenda to be accomplished in 100 days. But he has added thousands of jobs, but he has, doubled youth employment. And this summer, the amount of jobs accomplished so far has fallen short by about 700, I think, and there was some confusion over the demographic data. I think, he and his base will say dealing with root causes takes time, and I can't fix, 40 years. I think he says, 40 years of disinvestment in 1 year, whereas maybe his critics who want more, you know, law enforcement and criminal justice or other forms of accountability will say, well, you know, a lot of these shootings happen at hours where people aren't, where kids are not working. It's, you know, overnight hours.
Yeah.
And
so how is that going to help kind of thing, right? So, Pat, you hear Alice says there that the mayor's goal was to double youth employment by the end of his first term. Is there evidence that employing more teens results in lower crime rates?
There is some evidence. The University of Chicago studied at Chicago's job program years back and found that violent crime arrests among participants in the summer job program were lower than a control group. I've spoken to criminologists, however, and the problem is, and those researchers noted this as well, the kids who are signing up for a jobs program are largely not the young people who are most likely to be involved in gun violence.
Yeah.
And that's something the city has acknowledged. They're making efforts to try to reach sort of, you know, quote unquote, at risk. That's not the, I think they would call them youth of opportunity, but, you know, whatever term you want to use, kids who are the highest, young people who are at the highest risk of being involved in gun violence.
Yeah.
They're trying that, but that's a big issue. In addition to the hours that you're talking about, is the fact that if you're the kind of kid who's signing up for the One Summer Chicago program, you're probably not the super marginalized young person who's closest to gun violence.
Paris, tell us about these philanthropic leaders who pledged $100 million for community violence intervention this week. Who's behind the investment?
Well, it's the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago. It was started by the late Jim Crown, who was a billionaire from a very prominent family who died, unfortunately. But other folks took up the mantle and they gathered all these foundations and all these very wealthy people and said, like, we got to do something. We got to put our money where our mouth is. And so they did. $100 million, that's not a small investment. They said, this is just the beginning. It's going to go to groups like Chicago CRED, okay, which is Arnie Duncan's group, for community violence intervention. There's a handful of these nonprofit organizations that employ community violence interrupters. Mm-hmm. They basically go out on the street and they try to mediate gang conflicts or any conflict.
So that's the strategy. Okay.
That's the strategy before it gets to the point of gun violence. And a lot of times these intervention workers are former gang members themselves, or they are former perpetrators of gun violence and they've reformed themselves. And so they have credibility in the community. There is evidence that in the communities where this is employed, it works. The thing is, it's only employed in about something like 15 to 20% of where it needs to be.
Right.
And that's what this investment is about, is expanding it.
In your view, Pat, are these programs working?
Yeah, to Paris's point, I mean, almost every one of these bigger community violence intervention programs has researchers attached to it, either University of Chicago or Northwestern or UIC. And what they found is, like I was talking about with the summer jobs program, for the people who they reach, the high-risk people who actually get in the door or get touched by one of these workers, they lower their chances of being a victim of gun violence. They lower their chances of being arrested for a violent crime. The issue that we've seen is that so far, we haven't seen like sustained effect on overall violence rates from these programs. And the proponents of it would say that's because it's not scaled up. Mm-hmm. To Paris's point, we're only reaching a handful of the people that we really need to reach if you want to make a dent. They compare the investment in the work they do to the billion plus that we spend on police each year, and they say you're demanding more of us than you demand from CPD. This investment from the philanthropic community, which I'll note is not just a pledge. They pledged it before Jim Crown died. They raised it. I mean, they yeah. pledged it, and now they've got the money, and they say more is to come. That's going to go, you know, towards scaling this up, which has been going on for the last 5+ years.
Well, earlier this hour, I mean, we were talking about the Democratic Convention, folks, and so I'm curious how you all think Chicago's national reputation for crime will come into play when we're in the spotlight next month.
Well, you know, Republicans will certainly make an issue of that. They'll also make an issue of the migrant situation. It's interesting that's slowed down because everyone was thinking Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, is going to just send a bunch more migrants to try and cause chaos during the convention. I don't know if that's going to happen because the border is actually, there are less fewer border crossings. There are less migrants coming to Chicago, but certainly Governor Pritzker has a lot riding on this. He definitely wants that reputation not to proceed. And it's interesting, all this news this week about Biden and the conventions and stuff. If not for that, the 109 shootings would have been big national news.
Yeah.
And it kind of got buried nationally because of all these other things. It's kind of like the ADD of the national media. You know, they're interested in Chicago violence when there's nothing else to cover. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they haven't really spent a whole lot of time on it. And again, to Patrick's point, the numbers are down. We don't want to say numbers.
Instances?
The instances are down. You know, violent crime is down. It's down nationwide. It's not by a lot. And so that's the story Mayor Johnson wants to tell, basically.
Right. Chicago Inspector General Deborah Witzberg continues to raise questions about how the police department investigated 8 officers with ties to extremist groups. So she wanted CPD to reopen its investigation, Paris. How did the police department respond?
Nope, we're not going to do it. They basically just said no. And what she said is that their internal investigation was, quote unquote, materially deficient. There are these handful of police officers that had signed up for the Oath Keepers or for the Proud Boys. And I think the police department's point is, is it freedom of speech? Is it freedom of association? What are we supposed to do? If we fire them, there'll be lawsuits. Yeah. You know, the FOP will bring lawsuits. And a lot of these officers said, well, I was going to get a free gun, or I didn't know what I was signing up for. I didn't know about, this was before January 6th. I mean, the other thing is, you know, the IG did her own investigation and concluded differently. She also said that Mayor Johnson hasn't done enough himself, and he pledged that this was a big deal to him. She was recommending he put together an all-of-government task force to kind of come up with policy and recommendations. He said, this is a big deal, but we're going to just kind of go with our police department.
He was asked about it on Monday, and he said something like, I haven't read up enough about the case.
That's really interesting. The case is out there for everybody to read.
This is at the Stalin
for a long time.
Yeah, and Alice, I mean, I wonder if you're surprised by the police department's apparent tolerance of officers being involved with extremist groups.
Yeah, I'm interested about how that is going on under Johnson, because I feel like David Brown and Lori Lightfoot had a very different relationship or dynamic than Larry Snelling and Brandon Johnson. And sometimes when I see them on stage, talking with their various rhetorics, it seems a little strange to me.
So Patrick, I mean, so far they've only disciplined one officer. How does this impact the relationship between the police and the public, especially in Black and brown communities? Kind of what we just talked about.
Yeah, you know, it might surprise you to hear this, Sasha. I don't think it has a positive impact on that relationship. You know, I think...
Shocked.
I think a lot of people don't know about it, but the people who are aware of it, and there's a lot of people who are or hear enough about it, it sort of feeds into all the worst stereotypes about Chicago police and the Chicago Police Department, that it's filled with racist whites, that there's no discipline or no accountability for problematic officers. We hear police officers say, I don't want to be lumped in with one bad apple, or don't let, a couple bad cops paint us with a broad brush.
Yeah.
You have an instance here where you've identified those problem officers and the department is not taking action. I'm surprised by that. I know there's due process. There are rules around this. I am surprised. It seems like under Mayor Brandon Johnson, the department would be pretty, really under any mayor, would be pretty incentivized to take action on these officers.
I mean, in his campaign, Alice, he promised to fire CPD members with ties to, far-right extremist groups. Why isn't that happening?
I'm not sure, but a lot of... the reactions when Mayor Johnson is asked about that is he talks about co-governance and delegation and, needing to confer with other groups. And CPD does have a different layer of, I think Patrick can explain it better than me, but I think Anthony Driver has come out talking about this too recently.
Yeah, I mean, there's a discipline process. It's not as if the mayor can unilaterally fire an officer. And I think that's probably a good thing overall, that the mayor just can't just go pluck one individual employee out and fire them. But there are things the department could do to set its own discipline and accountability mechanism in action. They could even move to fire these officers and force the appeals court or the police board to undo it. I mean, politically, wouldn't that be better for Johnson to say, hey, look, I tried to fire these guys who signed up for the Proud Boys and a judge wouldn't let me. That seems like it would be more of an, I'm not saying I want these officers to be tried by a kangaroo court or anything, but politically it seems like a bizarre decision not to take action.
Many downtown streets are finally open again. This is after last weekend's NASCAR race, but the last of the road closures aren't expected to be cleared until July 18th. For the second year in a row, the race was delayed because of storms. Alice, what do you think the final verdict is on how it actually played out for the city and for NASCAR?
Based on my interactions with the mayor at his press conference on Monday after the race, it seems likely that, it's going to happen a third year. I don't know if it'll be renewed for the 2 years that the contract allows an extension for, but he dodged the question I asked about the $2 million handshake deal that NASCAR promised the city to reimburse for overtime. And obviously there was that Block Club story from Melody Mercado where she talked about how vendors in Grant Park are still waiting for the buyouts from NASCAR for the losses from their sales that weekend.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. So they didn't receive any confirmation, the vendors, of the buyout?
I think they received confirmation from
at the last minute or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics, but it sounds like they are owed money and the rent is really expensive there, so they are struggling.
I bet.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the second in a 3-year contract with the city to host this race. Do you all feel certain that we're going to see this again next summer? Is it coming back?
There, correct me if I'm wrong, there is an option to opt yes. out. And the mayor on Monday at that violence press conference said he's going to review whether this weekend, the 4th of July weekend, is the appropriate yes. time to have this, given concerns that perhaps officers were diverted to this that could have been in neighborhoods helping police crime. It's rained 2 years. We still haven't seen it where it's, you know, perfectly sunny out the entire weekend. And whether or not this is an economic boon to the city of Chicago. But I think that most economists look at these things and say pretty much no. I mean, it's a wash. And these hotels would be full up anyway for the right. holiday weekend. It seemed like the mayor was pretty skeptical, even though he was happy to don the fire suit and drive the car, you know, the pace car on over the weekend. I think it's 50-50.
Well, some people love fast cars and feel the need for speed.
Tracy Chapman, you got a fast car. She loves fast cars. Right.
Well, others are actually just hoping to make it where they can go, or where they want to go on time and safely.
There's a segue right there.
Yeah.
That's a professional segue.
I mean, it's what I do. Some of those people showed up at the first 6 public hearings about merging the region's 3 transit agencies, Paris.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The leaders of these transit agencies, CTA, PACE, and METRA, and then there's the RTA, they don't like this merger idea. Why? Because they'll lose their little fiefdoms, and each of these, you know, transit systems have their own boards. I mean, METRA has something like a 16-member board. RTA has like a 13-member board. And the main thing is the governor and the mayor and all these county officials get to appoint members to these boards. Remember when Mayor Johnson tried to appoint a campaign supporter, Reverend Ira Acree, to the RTA board, and then he said he didn't really know that much about public transit, so his nomination got tanked. So these are political chits for the mayor and the governor and politicians, and they don't want that to go away. But all right, this is getting way too in the weeds. There's a proposal out there to merge all of this into one super agency where you can take one fare card and get on the CTA and then get on the Metra and get on PACE, and you don't have to buy new cards.
And you mean Toronto's been doing for years?
Like Toronto's been doing for years. They also have high-speed rail to the airport in Toronto.
But go on, Chicago.
Okay, so it makes all the sense in the world.
It
and
totally
lawmakers
does.
Who have proposed this have said, by the way, if you agree to do this and cut all this bureaucracy, we'll give you $1.5 billion extra dollars every year to operate your systems, and you're crying for money. Here's a shameless plug. Tune in to Paris on Politics tonight at 10 p.m. I've got a commentary on this.
Nice.
10 p.m. I'm going to make a nice little commentary, more than what I'm saying right now. So, long story short, the proposal to merge these agencies to get more money, to save costs, the leaders of the CTA, PACE, and METRA do not want to do that. And the governor's lukewarm on it, too.
Yeah, CTA President Dorval Carter said safety on the CTA would improve if public safety in general improved. Does he have a point, Alex, Patrick?
I mean, having lived in other cities with where people use transit a lot, I feel like there is a little bit of a difference in CTA at like MTA or Metro or whatever. But I don't have the stats off the top of my head. But
well, I mean, I think overall, yeah, sure, his point is correct. I mean,
if we improve
on the
safety
CTA
in general,
reflects safety in the city. I think that's probably true.
I think having more people also just
right.
Yeah.
Well, and that doesn't mean CTA has no responsibility to try to keep its trains and buses safe and clean and things that people want to ride. But yeah, I think overall, of course, if Chicago was safer, the CTA would be safer.
Well, let's steer this conversation to the West Suburbs, shall we? Where the public library in River Forest has hired private security due to ongoing threats to staff. What's happening, Patrick?
Yeah, ABC 7 reports the library has been forced to open later than normal on some days because of threats made against the library and library staff. Apparently, this stems from an incident that happened all the way back in April when someone was banned from the library for breaking policies. The threats have been going on since then. I think it's important to note, last year we had a string of suburban libraries that faced bomb threats as part of this sort of hysteria over LGBTQ plus books at libraries. This does not seem, based on the reporting, this does not seem to be part of that, or at least it's not part of, it's not connected to that string of them that we saw last year. This seems to be linked to this one person who was apparently banned from the library, although I don't know about that person's motivations or what prompted this.
I said my love to the River Forest Library. I grew up, I lived in the River Forest Library. I read the Boxcar Children and Woodlawn Boys and the Hardy Boys sitting in that library. So you're doing great work and keep it up. And it's such an important institution.
Absolutely. So you know that here on The Recap, we like to not only cover the major headlines of the week, but also stories that might not be getting as much attention as they should. I know, Paris, you have been doing a lot of reporting about a product similar to cannabis that's completely unregulated. So tell us what you've been learning about Delta 8.
Yeah, Delta 8. So if you go to head shops or gas stations, you'll see these products called Delta 8. It gets you high. And it's legal thanks to a loophole in federal law, the Farm Bill. It allowed THC derived from hemp. The thing is, there are no regulations on this whatsoever. You know that legal cannabis, there's tons of regulation. The state has to go through all kinds of testing to ensure quality. With Delta 8, there's none of that. And so we interviewed a young woman in LaSalle County who had bought a Delta 8 product at a gas station and had a full-on psychiatric meltdown and was hallucinating for a month and was in the hospital for a month. And she's 4 months out of this and starting to recover. But she was diagnosed with drug-induced psychosis, and it ruined her life. It changed her life. And they think that it was because it was a very high concentration of THC, like super high. And that's the point. They could say one thing, it's only 10 milligrams or 20 milligrams, but it could be 100 milligrams. Yeah. You just have no way of knowing, and that's the problem. And the state failed to pass a ban or regulations, and governor said, you know, this is a priority. We need to start regulating this.
Well, we try to end the recap on a positive note.
That's not a positive note.
So this has been a very tough news week. I want to make sure I acknowledge that. Obviously, we had to cover a lot of those tough stories today, this hour, and I do extend my sincerest thanks to you three, but I wonder if any of you have walked into the building with some good news that you could share. Maybe something that made you smile this week that you saw, a headline that was, you know?
Yeah. An update from my union. So the Chicago Tribune News Guild unionized over 5 years ago. And, you know, it's been years and years and we still don't have a fair contract that pays our minority and female reporters equitably. But this week we finally sensed a shift where we noticed the company is on the defensive and we had the upper hand during 2 days of negotiations. And I just want to shout out our bargaining team.
Yes.
And that, you know, the concrete wall that is Alden Global Capital is showing cracks. And that is all I'll say on that.
That is good. Fantastic news for journalists,
right? I like that.
Any more good news stories before I wrap this up?
You know, Bianca here at WBEZ had a story about the best places to read a book in Chicago, and I told her to stop telling people about the grass just by the Montrose Bird Point Sanctuary, Montrose Point Bird Sanctuary. But now here I am saying it on your show as well. It is one of the best places.
You just told thousands of people.
But anyway, go check it out if you're looking for a good place to read a book in the city.
All right, we'll leave it there. My thanks to WBEZ's Patrick Smith, Alice Yin of the Chicago Tribune and Paris Schutz for joining us. Wishing you all a wonderful weekend.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Max Lubers. The news can feel overwhelming, so this recap helps you get the biggest headlines all in less than an hour. But if you want some quick updates throughout the week, you can sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays and gives you the news you need to know, along with the best of Chicago's culture. Subscribe at WBEZ.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.